Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Today, I'd like to begin by speaking about an issue that's important to every American, that is health care for all, more specifically Medicare for all in today's political environment. And I'd like to read an article from The Nation. And this is an article written by two healthcare researchers, and it's entitled "The Public Option on Healthcare is a Poison Pill," addressing the poison of free market and so-called competition on delivering affordable and effective healthcare for all. Okay, here we go. Healthcare reform has been the most hotly contested issue in the Democratic presidential debates. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have been pushing a single-payer Medicare for all plan, under which a public insurer would cover everyone. They would ban private insurance except for items not covered by the public plan, such as cosmetic surgery or private rooms in hospitals. The other Democratic contenders favor a, quote, public option reform that would introduce a Medicare-like public insurer but would allow private insurers to operate as well. They tout this approach as a less traumatic route to universal coverage that would preserve a free choice of insurers for people happy with their plans. And some public option backers go further, claiming that the system would painlessly transition to single payer as the public plan outperforms the private insurers. That's comforting rhetoric, but the case for a public option rests on faulty economic logic and naive assumptions about how private insurance actually works. Private insurers have proved endlessly creative at gaming the system to avoid fair competition, and they have used their immense lobbying clout to undermine regulators' efforts to rein in their abuses. That has enabled them to siphon hundreds of billions of dollars out of the healthcare system each year for their own profits and overhead costs, while forcing doctors and hospitals to waste billions more on billing-related paperwork. These dollars have to come from somewhere. If private insurers required their customers to pay the full cost of private plans, they wouldn't be able to compete with a public plan like the traditional Medicare program, whose overhead costs are far lower. But this is not the case. In fact, taxpayers, including those not enrolled in a private plan, pick up the tab for much of private insurers' profligacy. And the high cost of keeping private insurance alive would make it prohibitively expensive to cover the 30 million uninsured in the United States and to upgrade coverage for the tens of millions with inadequate plans. Public option proposals come in three main varieties. Medicare for all. A simple buy-in. Some proposals, including those by Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg, would offer a Medicare-like public plan for sale alongside private plans on the insurance exchanges now available under the Affordable Care Act. These buy-in reforms would minimize the need for new taxes, since most enrollees would be charged premiums, but tens of millions would remain uninsured or with coverage so skimpy they still couldn't afford care. Next option, pay or play. This variant, similar to the plan advanced by the Center for American Progress and endorsed by Beto O'Rourke, would offer employers a choice between purchasing private insurance or paying a steep payroll tax, about 8%. Anyone lacking employer-paid private coverage would be automatically enrolled in the public plan. The public option would be a good deal for employers who would otherwise have to pay more than 8% of their payroll for private coverage. For example, Employers with older or mostly female workers who tend to use more care and incur higher premiums, or with lots of low-wage workers for whom 8% of payroll is a relatively small sum. But many firms employing mostly young, male, or highly paid workers, such as finance or tech, would likely stay with the private insurer. Third option, Medicare Advantage for all. The public option approach favored by Kamala Harris would mimic the current Medicare Advantage program. Medicare Advantage plans are commercial managed care products currently offered by private insurers to seniors, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS. The federal agency that administers Medicare collects the taxes that pay for the program and passes the funds, $233 billion in 2018, along to the insurance companies. Under this approach, the public option would operate alongside the private Medicare Advantage plans and compete with them, as a traditional fully public Medicare program currently does. No working models of the buy-in or pay-or-play public option variants currently exist in the United States or elsewhere. But decades of experience with Medicare Advantage offer lessons about that program and how private insurers capture profits for themselves and push losses onto their public rival, strategies that allow them to win the competition while driving up everyone's costs. In U.S. health insurance, good guys finish last. A public option plan that facilitates enrollees' genuine access to health care can't compete with private insurers that avoid the expensively ill and obstruct access to care. Despite having overhead costs almost seven times that of traditional Medicare, 13.7% versus 2%, Medicare Advantage plans have grown rapidly. They now cover more than one-third of Medicare beneficiaries, up from 13% in 2005. Greed has trumped efficiency, and the efforts of regulators to level the playing field have been overwhelmed by insurers' profit-driven schemes to tilt it. Private insurers employ a dizzying array of profit-enhancing schemes that would be out of bounds for a public plan. These schemes, which continually evolve in response to regulators' efforts to counter them, boil down to four strategies that are legal in addition to occasional outright fraud. First, obstructing expensive care. Plans try to attract profitable, low-needs enrollees by assuring convenient and affordable access to routine care for minor problems. Simultaneously, they erect barriers to expensive services that threaten profits. For example, prior authorization requirements, high copayments, narrow networks, and drug formulary restrictions that penalize the unprofitably ill. While the fully public Medicare program contracts with any willing provider, many private insurers exclude, for example, cystic fibrosis specialists, and few Medicare Advantage plans cover care at cancer centers like Memorial Sloan Kettering. Moreover, private insurers' drug formularies often put all of the drugs, even cheap generics, needed by those with diabetes, schizophrenia, or HIV in a high copayment tier. Insurers whose first reaction to a big chill is claim denied discourage many patients from pursuing their claims. And as discussed below, if hassling over claims drives some enrollees away, even better, the sickest will be the most hassled and therefore the most likely to switch to a competitor. Next strategy, cherry picking and lemon dropping, or selectively enrolling people who need little care and disenrolling the unprofitably ill. A relatively small number of very sick patients account for the vast majority of medical costs each year. A plan that dodges even a few of these high-needs patients wins, while a competing plan that welcomes all comers loses. In the employer market, cherry-picking is easy. Private insurers offer attractive premiums to businesses with young, healthy workers and exorbitant rates to those with older, sicker employees. As a letter this summer to the New York Times puts it, like casinos, health insurers are profitable because they know the odds of every bet they place, and the house always wins. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, in theory, requires Medicare Advantage plans to take all comers and prohibits them from forcing people out when they get sick. But regulators' efforts to enforce these requirements have been overwhelmed by insurers' chicanery. To avoid the sick, private insurers manipulate provider networks and drug formulary designs. Despite the ban to forcing enrollees out, patients needing high-cost services like dialysis or nursing home care have switched in droves from private plans to traditional, fully public Medicare. And as a last resort, Medicare Advantage plans will stop offering coverage in a county where they've accumulated too many unprofitable enrollees, akin to a casino ejecting players who are beating the house. Finally, Medicare Advantage plans cherry-pick through targeted marketing schemes. In the past, this has meant sign-up dinners in restaurants difficult to access for people, difficult to access for people who use wheelchairs, or offering free fitness center memberships, a perk that appeals mainly to the healthiest seniors. But higher-tech approaches are just around the corner. Will Oscar, the health insurer founded by Jared Kushner's brother, with Google's parent company as a significant investor, resist the temptation to use Google's trove of personal data to target enrollment ads towards profitable enrollees like tennis enthusiasts and avoid purchasers of plus-size clothing or people who have searched online for fertility treatments? Upcoding or making enrollees look sicker on paper when they really are to inflate risk-adjusted premiums. To counter cherry-picking, the CMS pays Medicare Advantage plans higher premiums for enrollees with more and more serious diagnoses. For instance, a Medicare Advantage plan can collect hundreds of dollars more each month from the government by labeling an enrollee's temporary sadness as major depression, or calling trivial knee pain degenerative arthritis. By applying serious-sounding diagnoses to minor illnesses, Medicare Advantage plans artificially inflate the premiums they collect from taxpayers by billions of dollars, while adding little or nothing to their expenditures for care. Though most upcoding stays within the letter of the law and merely stretches medical terminology, the CMS's rare audits of enrollees' charts indicate that Medicare Advantage plans are collecting $10 billion annually from taxpayers for entirely fabricated diagnoses. And that's only a small fraction of the overall take from upcoding. Private insurers keep most of this pilfered money for their profits and overhead, but they use a portion to fund added benefits, for example, eyeglasses or slightly lower co-payments for routine care, that attract new enrollees and help private plans to seemingly outcompete traditional Medicare. Next strategy, lobbying to get excessive payments and thwart regulators. Congress has mandated that the CMS overpay Medicare Advantage plans by 2% and even more where medical costs are lower than average. On top of that, Seema Verma, Trump's CMS administrator, has taken steps that will increase premiums significantly and award unjustified, quote, quality bonuses, ignoring advice from the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission that payments be trimmed because the government is already overpaying the private plans. And she has ordered the changes to the CMS's Medicare website to trumpet the benefits of Medicare Advantage enrollment. In sum, a public option insurer that, like traditional Medicare, doesn't try to dodge unprofitable enrollees would be saddled with more than its share of sick, expensive patients and would become a de facto high-cost, high-risk pool. The CMS's decades-long effort to level the playing field has been thwarted by insurers upcoding, belying their promises to fair competition. And insurance companies have used their political muscle to sustain and increase their competitive advantage over traditional Medicare. The result? The public plan and the taxpayers absorb the losses while private insurers skim off profits, an imbalance so big that private plans can outcompete a public plan despite squandering vast sums on overhead costs, CEO salaries, and shareholder profits. Single payer would save, the public option won't. This year alone, private insurers will take in $252 billion more than they pay out, equivalent to 12% of their premiums. A single-payer system with overhead costs comparable to Medicare's 2% could save about $220 billion of that money. A public option would save far less, possibly zero, if much of the new public coverage is channeled through Medicare Advantage plans, whose overhead, at 13.7%, is even higher than the average commercial insurer. Moreover, a public option would save little or nothing on hospitals and doctors' sky-high billing and administrative costs. In a single-payer system, hospitals and other health facilities could be funded via global lump-sum budgets, similar to the way cities pay fire departments, eliminating the need to attribute costs to individual patients and collect payments from them and their insurers. That global budget payment strategy has cut administrative costs at hospitals in Canada and Scotland to half the U.S. level. The persistence of multiple payers would preclude such administrative streamlining, even if all the payers are charged the same rates. Under Maryland's mislabeled global budget system, The state's hospitals charge uniform rates but continue to bill per patient. Our research indicates that their administrative costs haven't fallen at all, according to their official cost reports. Similarly, for physicians and other practitioners, the complexity involved in billing multiple payers, dealing with multiple drug formularies and referral networks, collecting copayments and deductibles, and obtaining referrals and prior authorizations drives up office overhead costs and documentation burdens. The excess overhead inherent to multi-payer systems imposes a hidden surcharge on the fees that doctors and hospitals must charge all patients, not just those covered by private insurance. All told, a public option reform would sacrifice about $350 billion annually of single payers' potential savings on providers' overhead costs, over and above the $220 billion in savings it could sacrifice annually on insurers' overhead. Finally, a public option would undermine the rational health planning that is key to the long-term savings under single payer. Each dollar that a hospital invests in new buildings or equipment increases its operating cost by 20 to 25 cents in every subsequent year. At present, hospitals that garner profits, or surpluses for nonprofits, have the capital to expand money-making services and buy high-tech gadgets, whether they're needed or not, while neglecting vital but unprofitable services. For instance, hospitals around the country have invested in proton beam radiation therapy centers that cost hundreds of million dollars apiece. Oklahoma City alone now has two. Yet there's little evidence that those machines are any better for most uses than their far cheaper alternatives. Similarly, hospitals have rushed to open invasive cardiology and orthopedic surgery programs, often close to existing ones. These duplicative investments raise costs and probably compromise quality. Meanwhile, primary care and mental health services have languished, and rural hospitals and other cash-strapped facilities that provide much-needed care spiral toward closure. As in Canada and several European nations, a single-payer system could fund new hospital investments through government grants based on an explicit assessment of needs instead of counting on private hospitals to use their profits wisely. That strategy has helped other nations direct investments to areas and services with the greatest need and to avoid funding wasteful or redundant facilities. Public option proposals would perpetuate current payment strategies that distort investment and raise long-term costs. Because a public option would leave the current dysfunctional payment approach in place, it would sacrifice most of the savings available via single-payer reform. The bottom line is that a public option would either cost much more or deliver much less than single-payer. A final point. While allowing private insurance to compete with a public plan amounts to a poison pill, the same isn't true for supplemental private plans that are allowed to cover only those items excluded from the public benefit package. While Canada bans the sale of private coverage that duplicates the public plan's benefits, it has always allowed supplemental coverage, and that hasn't sabotaged its system. The efficiencies of a single-payer system would make universal coverage affordable and give everyone in the United States their free choice of doctors and hospitals. But that goal will remain out of reach if private insurers are allowed to continue gaming the system. Preserving the choice of insurers for some would perpetuate the affordability crisis that has bedeviled the U.S. healthcare system for generations. Proponents of the public option portray it as a non-disruptive, free-choice version of single-payer. That may be good campaign rhetoric, but it's terrible policy. Well, my friends, you're likely only to get that kind of detailed analysis here on your own WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, your local school of public health. The only thing I'll add to that universal healthcare single payer debate is that actually those with private insurance have less satisfaction than those with public insurance. And private employer-based insurance only represents about half of those that are actually insured in this country. In other countries, they have about half the cost with single payer, although they've developed infrastructures that are more reasonable. So we'd be still continuing to pay for that expensive infrastructure probably for decades to come. But people in those countries report much higher levels of satisfaction with their healthcare system. Probably not hard to compete with a crappy level of satisfaction that we have of Americans. So having something that's works better for people, provides better health outcomes, and is cheaper sounds like a good idea.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming. Powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, let's continue our show with the public health news and research roundup, where I gather up all the wonderful things in the world of public health so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research Roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
Okay, first up, let's start with a healthcare story. This from The Hill. Number of uninsured children rises for second year, tops 4 million. The number of uninsured children in the U.S. increased for the second year in a row and now tops 4 million, the most since Obamacare became law, according to a new report released. According to the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families, the number of uninsured children increased by more than 400,000 between 2016 and 2018. The report found that the increase has wiped out a large share of the coverage gains made since the enactment of the health care law in 2014 and is due in large part to policies championed by the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress. According to researchers, Obamacare helped more children obtain health coverage, but beginning in 2017, the number of uninsured children began to rise. The report specifically cited the confusion surrounding the administration's failed attempt to repeal Obamacare, the successful elimination of the law's individual mandate, and a months-long delay in funding the Children's Health Insurance Program. In addition, the report cited the Trump administration's decision to dramatically cut Obamacare outreach and enrollment grants while also shortening the open enrollment period. At a time when families need more help navigating the confusing health coverage landscape, fewer resources are available for Obamacare outreach and enrollment efforts as a result of cuts made by the administration in 2017. Texas has the largest proportion of uninsured children and is home to more than 1 in 5 uninsured children in the U.S. 3/4 of the children who lost coverage between 2016 and 2018 live in GOP-led states that have not expanded Medicaid. The uninsured rate for children in those states increased at 3 times the rate as children in expansion states. The majority of uninsured children are eligible for Medicaid or CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, but are not currently enrolled. The decline in health coverage occurred at a time when children should have been gaining coverage in the private market and as a red flag for policymakers, as even more children would likely lose coverage in an economic downturn, said Joan Alker, executive director of the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. Researchers also pointed to President Trump's crackdown on immigration as a reason why the number of uninsured kids is rising. Several policies targeting immigrant communities, like the administration's public charge rule, are likely deterring parents from enrolling their eligible children in Medicaid or CHIP, despite the fact that most of the children are U.S. citizens. Okay, next up from Stat News. Widely used algorithm for follow-up care in hospitals is racially biased, study finds. An algorithm commonly used by hospitals and other health systems to predict which patients are most likely to need follow-up care classified white patients overall as being more ill than black patients, even when they were just as sick, a new study finds. Overall, only 18% of the patients identified by the algorithm as needing more care were black, compared to about 82% of the white patients. If the algorithm were to reflect the true proportion of the sickest black and white patients, those figures should have been about 46 and 53% respectively. All told, health systems use the algorithm for some 100 million people across the country. The study's authors then retrained a new algorithm using patients' biological data rather than the insurance claims data that the original program used and found an 84% reduction in bias. Previously, the algorithm was failing to account for a collective nearly 50,000 chronic conditions experienced by black patients. After rejiggering the algorithm, that number dropped to fewer than 8,000. The reduction in bias emphasized that many in the health technology field believe algorithms may only be as good as the data behind them. Who uses the algorithm you examined? It's a category of algorithms of which there are several manufacturers. Looking at past health records, they predict future health. It's applied by health systems to over 100 million people, so quite widespread. And it's used for care coordination programs. These algorithms are meant to flag people for the chance that in the next year they'll need extra care. Healthcare systems take these algorithms and use them to rank people and say these are some of the people who might need extra help. For example, if you have diabetes and heart disease, you're going to be at the hospital a lot. We might give you a dedicated nurse who can tell you whether to come in or not. Sometimes it's making sure they don't come into the emergency room, but go to a special desk instead. What did you find? We thought if this algorithm were unbiased, it shouldn't matter whether the person is black or white. But we found that similarly sick black patients are ranked much lower by the algorithm as less sick than white patients. This basically says that care coordination programs, this part of how we're coordinating such programs, is having massive gaps. Is there a way to fix it? When we retrained a new algorithm on actual physiological variables, the gap then completely disappears. And it turns out you can get almost all of the efficiency properties of the original algorithm without the racial gap. Yep, garbage in, garbage out. Beware of artificial intelligence as a substitute for actual intelligence. Okay, next up from Science Daily. Women scientists author fewer invited commentaries in medical journals than men. Women scientists were 21% less likely to author invited commentaries in medical journals during a 5-year period than men with similar scientific expertise, seniority, and publication metrics, according to a new study led by researchers from the Harvard School of Public Health and in collaboration with Elsevier, a medical journal publisher. They found that the disparity was larger for women who were further progressed in their careers, reaching as high as 40% for the most senior authors. Discrimination against women is widespread throughout society, and really smart people are not exempt from that. Okay, this from The Hill. Dementia impacts women more, and new approaches are needed. Americans are living longer thanks to medical and public health advances and greater access to health care. If you're a 65-year-old man in the U.S., you can expect to live another 20 years. American women can expect to live even longer, to the age 86 and a half. While this is good news for most of us, increased longevity also creates new challenges. After we turn 65, our risk of developing dementia doubles every 5 years. By age 85, nearly 1 in 3 of us will have the disease. The impact on women is even greater. By 2020, roughly 4.7 million women in the U.S. will have dementia, accounting for nearly 2/3 of everyone living with the disease. Women often experience a double whammy. Not only are they more likely to get the disease, they're also more likely to take on most caregiving responsibilities for spouses, parents, in-laws, and friends. Women caregivers are more likely to be impacted financially as they leave jobs or miss work to care for family members. The economic costs of treatment, care, and lost productivity due to women suffering from Alzheimer's and dementia will total $2.1 trillion by 2040, representing over 80% of the cumulative costs. Communities of color face an even greater threat. Older African Americans have the highest risk of dementia, followed by American Indians, Alaska Natives, and Latinos. This increased risk, coupled with income differences and cultural attitudes towards family caregiving, results in communities of color shouldering more direct care for people living with dementia than white populations. Thanks to increased National Institute of Health funding to study Alzheimer's disease, researchers today understand better dementia's pathology. Perhaps most hopeful for those of us at high risk for dementia, emerging evidence shows that despite family history and personal genetics, lifestyle changes such as diet, exercise, and better sleep can improve brain health. Increased participation by women in clinical trials has helped us understand why more women than men have dementia. Researchers believed dementia is primarily connected to longer life expectancy, but new studies have linked it to biological differences, such as hormonal imbalances that change brain chemistry. Most importantly, we must spread awareness of how individuals, communities, and health professionals can improve cognitive function and brain health for all ages. If we can delay the onset of dementia by only 5 years, we can cut the incidence in half. With more women working full-time and family size decreasing, we must increase efforts to create a dementia-capable workforce to effectively identify people with dementia, tailor services to meet their needs and those of their caregivers, and ensure those living with dementia get the right care at the right time. Okay, this next report comes from the Irony Desk. Tap water at Trump National Golf Course contaminated with toxic forever chemicals. This from Newsweek. The Environmental Working Group has found that high levels of perfluorooctanoic acid, PFOA, and other perfluorinated chemicals, PFAS, have been detected in tap water at Trump National Golf Course in Bedminster, New Jersey. PFAS are often called forever chemicals because they don't break down once they enter the environment and can cause buildup in the blood and organs of people exposed to them. President Donald Trump has frequently used the private club for meetings with public officials and referred to the compound as, quote, the summer White House. The PFOA levels reached 3.5 and 3.6 parts per trillion at Trump's Jersey golf course. This is much higher than what the Environmental Working Group safety threshold, which recommends that any more than one part per trillion is unsafe for human consumption. Despite research from the Environmental Working Group and independent scientists, the Safe Drinking Water Act does not place a legal limit on PFAS. A relatively simple solution exists to reduce PFAS in water, Scott Fiber, the Environmental Working Group's Vice President for Government Affairs, likened the granular activated carbon filtration system to a really big Brita filter. It works by flushing the contaminated water over a bed of carbon, and the PFAS attaches to the carbon so it doesn't wind up in the filtered water. There are filtration systems that are already being adopted around the country at every scale you can imagine. Environmental Working Group President Ken Cook condemned the private club for charging expensive membership fees while failing to provide something as fundamental as suitable drinking water. I suppose one would hope after they've spent more than $250,000 just to get in the door, President Trump could at least give his members filtered drinking water free of cancer-causing chemicals. Cook pointed to the many other cases of PFOA-contaminated drinking water, explaining that the golf course is a microcosm of a larger problem. But if he's going to refuse to enact policies to clean up drinking water contamination for the rest of the country, why should the foursome waiting to tee off in the back nine be treated any different? The president may be getting a literal taste of his own medicine, according to Faber. I think it's sadly ironic that a president who has done more to weaken clean water protections has been serving contaminated water to his own guests. Okay, well, let's finish off with something more good news here. This from Science Daily. Restoring native vegetation could cut air pollution and cost, study finds. Adding plants and trees to the landscapes near factories and other pollution sources could reduce air pollution by an average of 27%, new research suggests. The study shows that plants, not technologies, may also be cheaper options for cleaning the air near a number of industrial sites, roadways, power plants, commercial boilers, and oil and gas drilling sites. In fact, researchers found that in 75% of the counties analyzed, it was cheaper to use plants to mitigate air pollution than it was to add technological interventions, things like smokestack scrubbers, to the source of the pollution. The fact is that traditionally, especially as engineers, we don't think about nature. We just focus on putting technology into everything, said Bhavik Bakshi, lead author of the study and professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering at the Ohio State University. And so, one key finding is that we need to start looking at nature and learning from it and respecting it. There are win-win opportunities if we do, opportunities that are potentially cheaper and better environmentally. To start understanding the effect that trees and other plants could have on air pollution, the researchers collected public data on air pollution and vegetation on a county-by-county basis across the lower 48 states. Then, they calculated what adding additional trees and plants might cost. Their calculations included the capacity of current vegetation, including trees, grasslands, and shrublands, to mitigate air pollution. They also considered the effect that restorative planning, bringing the vegetation cover of any given county to its county average levels of that area, might have on air pollution levels. They estimated the impact of plants on the most common air pollutants, sulfur dioxide, particulate matter that contributes to smog, and nitrogen dioxide. They found that restoring vegetation to county-level average canopy cover reduced air pollution an average of 27% across the counties. This figure varies by county and region. Consider, for example, a county in the desert of Nevada and county in the farmlands of Ohio. Even if the counties were the same size, the county average land cover in Nevada would be smaller than that in Ohio because the desert could not grow as much vegetation as farmland. They found that adding trees or other plants could lower air pollution levels in both urban and rural areas, though the success rates varied depending on, among other factors, how much land was available to grow new plants and the current air quality. Reducing air pollution is critical to public health. The American Lung Association estimates that 4 in 10 people in the U.S. live in areas with poor air quality, leading to health issues including asthma, lung cancer, and heart disease. Bakshi said their findings indicate that nature should be part of the planning process to deal with air pollution and show that engineers and builders should find ways to incorporate both technological and ecological systems. The thing we are interested in is basically making sure that engineering contributes positively to sustainable development. And one big reason why engineering has not done that is because engineering has kept nature outside of its system boundary. Okay, well, that's our show for today. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com, T-O-P-P-U-N.com. If you want to review this show, listen to any past shows, or queue up future shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. And I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.